Welcome to the First Century Church Podcast. My name is Stephen Wilhoy, and I'm the lead pastor at First Century Church, and it is an honor to have you with us today. The goal of the podcast is simple. We want you to be encouraged, challenged, and inspired to go further in your faith than ever before. If you'd like more information about the church, you can visit our website, firstcenturykc.com. And if you happen to be in the Kansas City area anytime soon, we'd love to have you join us for one of our live gatherings to connect with you in person. Again, thanks for joining us today, and we hope that you enjoy today's message. We are going to continue a series that we're in week three now. It's called Complex. We're working through the Old Testament book of Job, maybe an unlikely book of the Bible to preach through, but we're going to do it. We're going to do it no matter what, all right? And so we spent the last couple weeks giving some background to the story, to the person of Job. That was week one. And then last week we looked at another main character who's not as obvious, but is throughout the entirety sort of undergirding some of the themes and ideas behind this book. We looked at Satan last week, so a great Mother's Day sermon talking about Satan anyway, but we made it through. If you missed either one of those, you can catch up. I will give just at the very beginning, I'm going to try to be very brief on the intro to not cut in too much of our time together, but let me just set up the story and the stage for where Job is going to find himself as we start week three. So Job chapter one, we looked at Job is described as a man who is blameless, who is upright, who fears God and turns away from evil. So just a righteous man. But then in Job chapter one and two, Satan, who is his enemy, his accuser, basically his prosecutor, he challenges God and threatens Job. Look at what he says in Job 1, 11 and 12. Here's what Satan says. He says, "But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." That's what Satan says to God. "And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." And so from this moment, in a single afternoon, Job's life is turned completely upside down. In a matter of a few hours in that day, all of his animals, his crops, his property are destroyed, and all 10 of his children die. They're all gathered together feasting. The house they're in is blown over by a windstorm. All 10 children are dead. And so how did Job respond to that? We'll look at this. This is kind of be our theme for today a little bit. In Job chapter 1, after all this tragedy happens, verse 20 of Job 1 says this, "Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshiped. And he said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.' In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong." Now, you would think that for Satan, he's done enough. He's caused enough pain, enough damage, enough carnage, but he comes back for more. He comes back to God for round two in Job chapter two, and he says, yeah, he handled that fine, but if you let me touch him and destroy him, then he'll curse you right to your face. That's what he says in Job 2, verse 4. We'll look at this real quick. "Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life, but stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head." So if you're a person of a certain age, you will remember exactly where you were on Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. You probably know exactly where you were. I'm going to give away my age real quick. I was in 10th grade English lit class. So do the math, you'll figure out. I'm going to turn 40 in a few weeks. So I'll just tell you that's all I am, okay? So that's where I was in high school here in this moment. We were just doing our normal lesson like a Tuesday, like you always do. And then someone came in, whispered something to the teacher. And then the teacher left the room and we're like, this is weird, you know? And so then they come back in, they flip on the little TV screen in the corner and turn on the news. And you see the smoke coming from the World Trade Center in New York City. And so what we woke up like a normal Tuesday, and thousands of people in New York and Pennsylvania and D.C., they woke up on a Tuesday morning like a normal day, but that day was definitely not normal for thousands and thousands of people, 2,977 victims of that day that their lives were forever changed. Now, you may not know exactly where you were about 10 years later on March 11th, 2011. You may not know where you were. That may not mean anything to you. But everyone in the nation of Japan will know exactly where they were on that day. So at 2:46 in the afternoon of March 11th, 2011, a massive 9.1 earthquake just off the northeast coast of Japan shook the entire nation of Japan. And it lasted about 6 minutes in total. This is the fourth largest earthquake in recorded modern history. And that earthquake, as you probably remember, triggered a massive tsunami. So the people of Japan, after the 6 minutes of shaking, were warned to flee and evacuate. The problem is they only had 8 minutes to get away and nowhere to go. And so later that afternoon, right at 3 o'clock, waves as high as 130 feet high, going at 400 miles an hour, stormed the northeastern coast of Japan. And on top of that, it happened, it was actually, it was 32 degrees Fahrenheit on that day. It was literally freezing in Japan on that day. And so after this massive tsunami struck Japan, a winter storm came through on top of that to make other rescue missions almost virtually impossible. So all told, this earthquake and tsunami in 2011 claimed the lives of 19,759 Japanese and injured another 6,200 more. And then over the course of the next 4 to 5 years, the NOAA is called the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They estimate that 635 metric tons of debris from Japan washed up on the western coast of the U.S. So over the course of months and years in Hawaii, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, buoys, boats, furniture, trash, personal belongings kept washing up on the shore. 635 metric tons of debris. Now, the reason I mention these two historical moments that happened one decade apart from each other is because what has happened to Job in Job 1 and 2 is as if both these events happened to him on the same weekend, virtually. So you look at what happened in Job 1, he's a victim of multiple terrorist attacks. People from neighboring countries or tribes have destroyed his animals and his livestock and his fields. They've all taken it. It's all gone. And then a fire, basically the way it's worded in Job 1, fire from heaven consumes other parts of his property and livestock. So a natural disaster. And then a windstorm kills all 10 of his children. Back-to-back events that you would never imagine as being possible. Now, as an aside, this is, going back to week one, this is actually one reason that some people see Job as a fictional story. So a person reading this would say, well, that can't be real. No one would endure that kind of tragedy all at once. That's just too good to be true, or not good to be true, but it's too much to be true. And so some would say, in addition to other issues we mentioned in week one, if you missed it, can catch it. They say it's too extreme to be real. Again, there's no evidence that it's not real. It's just this is the kind of suffering that this man in this Old Testament story endured. He is indeed going through extreme suffering. And after all of this tragedy and loss, look at one verse, Job chapter 2, verse 8. Here's all Job can do after all this. Job 2, verse 8. He took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. So Job wakes up like any other day, but before that day is over, all he has left are broken pottery shards and an ash heap. That's all he's got left. And if you remember how he started at the beginning of Job 1, we're talking thousands of camels, thousands of donkeys, 1,000 oxen. He's the richest, most wealthiest, most well-to-do man in the entire region. And now he's got a pottery shard to scrape his boils and sitting on an ash heap. And maybe to some degree, you can relate to where Job finds himself in this moment. Maybe you're sitting here thinking, been there, done that. I've got the scars to prove it. I've got the pottery shard in, you know, some kind of a box on my mantle to prove the pain I've been through. I've got the doctor's reports that I've saved in a folder. I've got the email saved. I've got this, you know, other thing happen in my life. I've got the tragic scars of life that I've been there and done that. Maybe you're there right now. It's not just been there, done that. It's doing that, feeling that. And maybe when you read that about Job having these boils from head to toe and just to get some relief, he's taken a broken pottery shard from an ash heap and is just trying to find some relief. Maybe you're like, yes, that describes me perfectly. I'm trying to find relief for this situation I'm in. I'm trying to find some sort of answers or reason or hope in whatever I'm dealing with. And so to help us deal with the things that we may be going through or will at some point deal with, and in a way to help maybe wrestle with our own suffering, whether now or in the future, we will take a few minutes today to examine Job's initial response that we've looked at to his suffering. In Job 1 and 2, in both of these sort of the terrorist attacks and the natural disasters, there's three things that Job does that we'll look at for a few minutes today to hopefully be encouraged by his initial response to the tragedy that he faces and put it into practice in our own lives. Now, I will give a disclaimer. Some may not be completely satisfied with Job's response. It's too pie in the sky. It's not realistic. If I suffered, I wouldn't react that way. If that's you, come back next week. Come back next week anyway. But next week, I said this is Job's initial response. In Job chapter 3, he has a second response, and it is very different from this one. And so if you don't like today, you'll like next week because I can relate to Job 3. Maybe not Job 1 and 2. I'm not there yet, but maybe Job 3. So we'll see his initial response today and then a secondary response next week in Job chapter 3. And along the way today, I'm going to quote several resources that I've been studying the last several months because they're going to bring out certain points in a way that it's just easier if they say it and I don't try to re-say it for them. And so quite a few quotes today. If you have the Bible app, today's a great day for you because it's all there. You don't have to write it down or take a screenshot. It's there. And so if you save it, you can have it to look at later this week if we get to going too fast, which I do. I know. So let's look at what Job does with his initial response to his suffering. Here's the first thing he does. It's very important. The first thing Job does is he acknowledges his loss. Job acknowledges his loss. Look again at Job chapter 1, verse 20. Then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and fell to the ground. All three of these descriptions are classical, ancient Near Eastern actions to signify mourning. So tearing one's robe signified brokenness and grief. And really the idea is, I don't really care about my outward appearance right now because the inside of me is a mess too. So you tear the robe, you tear your cloak or your garment in a sign of mourning and sadness. Shaving head. So hair in this culture would have been sort of a sign of dignity. And so in a time of mourning or grief or loss, shaving your head means I'm in an undignified state inwardly, and so I'm going to express that outwardly as a sign of grief and sadness. And then it says he just fell on the ground. I mean, how much lower can you be than face down in the dirt? I mean, that's about as low as you can get. That's about as bad as it can get other than being dead, which as we'll see, sometimes it feels like maybe that's the relief I want. But while we're stuck here living this life of suffering and pain and loss and tragedy at times, it's important that we see Job do this. It's important that we see him acknowledge his loss. So one of the more interesting resources I've been reading to study for this is actually a Hebrew commentary on the book of Job. Now, if you don't know, just a little fun fact, Hebrew is written right to left. We read left to right. Hebrew's backwards. And so this commentary isn't, there's a Hebrew part, but it's written in English, but you have to read it backwards to forwards. Like it's this page, then this page, you flip it backwards, this page. So sometimes I confuse. I'm like, wait, that's not where I am. Oh, I'm on this page, you know, so that happens. Here's one thing that I found fascinating, and it points this point out about him acknowledging his loss. So this commentary says this, not for one moment did Job permit himself the spurious luxury of denial. He did not need or seek to anesthetize his senses. He stood unbowed and unbroken because he knew himself to be in the hands of his God. But it's good for us to see Job sad here. Not because we want him to be sad, not because we're cheering on his grief. No, but it's because he shows himself to be very relatable. He's acknowledging life is difficult right now. He's not just skimming past the obvious. He's not doing that. He's going to show much more of that certainly next week in a different response altogether. But he shows us, Job does, I think, what true faith really looks like. Faith is not ignoring your pain. Faith is not wishing away the hard things that have happened to you. Faith is not sticking your fingers in your ears and going, blah, 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 blah. That's not what faith is. Faith does not require you to live in an alternate reality. Faith simply gives you a way to process your pain and your loss, to work through those human emotions, and then overcome difficulty, pain, tragedy, and loss that comes to all of us in a way that actually works. It's not numbing the pain. That doesn't work. Maybe for a while it does, but then it leads to other pain, okay? Just talking it out may be good, but that's not going to be good for long enough. It's not going to be good enough for long enough. There's got to be a faith component to actually sustain us in our pain, in our suffering, through our loss. Faith allows us to do that. Faith, honestly, it allows us to be honest about our pain, about our loss, to acknowledge it. The Psalms are full of this kind of language. Just look at just two examples really quickly about how, this is just two of many, many examples of how the Psalms do this all the time. So Psalm 18, verse 6 says this, "In my distress, I called upon the Lord. To my God, I cried for help. From his temple, he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears in my distress." So the psalmist is being very vulnerable here, saying, hey, I've got an issue. I'm dealing with something major here, but there's a faith component to it. In that moment, in that feeling, in that emotion, I'm going to do something about it. I call to the Lord. Then Psalm 61, verse 2, it says this, "From the ends of the earth, I cry to you for help. When my heart is overwhelmed," you ever been there before? "Lead me to the towering rock of safety." Faith allows us to be honest about suffering. It allows us to express discomfort and pain as a reality. Faith is not just wish it away, think it away, dream it away, just blah, 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 blah. That's not faith at all. That's foolishness, as we'll see here in just a minute. And look, go back to Job chapter 2, verse 8. Look at there's two things he does in this verse that I want to point out very quickly. Look at what he does here. First, he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself. So there's physical pain, obviously, that Job is enduring. Physical discomfort, sores from head to toe. And let me give you a list here. If you want the list with the references, I can get those to you. But here's a list. It's not just he had sores. It's what accompanied that and also what that led to in other ways. It affects his entire body. Every system of his body is affected. So throughout Job, he describes some of these symptoms or ailments throughout the book. So here's a few other things. The sores disfigured his skin. A lot of sores, he'll describe them as they scab over, then they crack and ooze again. Some sores are infected with worms. He develops a loss of appetite accompanied by severe weight loss. He deals with depression and sleeplessness. His eyes become swollen, probably from sores, and also he seems to say from weeping. He has halitosis, bad breath, probably from not eating. He talks about having diarrhea, having fever with chills, having continual pain throughout his entire body. There is physical pain he is enduring. We read the story and we just kind of think, oh, that's, you know, bad. But it's like he, you know, at some point, as we'll look at next week, would rather die than live through this. He's trying, he's scraping, he's trying to get relief, but man, he is hurting physically. But there's also an emotional component, emotional pain. So it says he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. That's an important thing. Let me just talk about it for just a second. What does this actually mean? He sits in the ashes. So most ancient cities, much like we have now, would have a landfill outside the city gate of that city. And typically they would burn trash or dead animal carcasses or other refuse in this sort of major burn pit. So it's likely what's happened here is, I don't know how far he lived from the city gate or from this point, but it seems that he has gone from maybe his home to the landfill, to the city dump, and he's sitting on a pile of burned trash, of ashes here. So he's sitting outside the city gates trying to scrape himself. So there's some deep emotional pain. So in the New Testament, when Jesus talks about hell, he uses a very specific word that I want to point to that will tie in to where Job is right now. So let me read these verses and I'll explain what he's talking about. So in Mark 9, 47, 48, Jesus says this, "If your eye causes you to sin, tear it out. It's better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into hell, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched." That word hell, we have a visual image of what that looks like, don't we? fire, heat, burning, whatever. That's what Jesus is saying, okay? So the word in Greek that he's using there is translated either as Gehenna or Gehenna. So the second one, the name there, is traditionally seen as a specific landfill outside of Jerusalem. And so it's a place of sadness. It's a place of death. It's a place where there's fire and sulfur burning everywhere all the time. So now I believe in a literal eternal hell. I think Jesus does too. But he's using this as an image of what hell is going to be like in some small measure. So when he says Gehenna as hell, which he does many times, that's the word that he uses over and over and over again. When he's just painting a visual picture for them to know, that's not where I want to end up. I don't want to end up there. But do you see that's where Job is right now? Literally, in the landfill, on an ash heap, with nothing. So it's not literal, but in a very, very strong figurative sense, Job is going through hell. He's in a living hell. He's sitting on hell, on an ash heap, right? Here, as Jesus describes it later, as what hell would be like. Job acknowledges his loss. He sits in his loss. But go back to chapter 1 for just a second and look. There's a glimmer of hope here in a weird way. Look at how Job describes his loss, who he gives credit, if you will, for his loss. Job 1:21, Job says, "The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away." We looked at last week, we have this cosmic courtroom scene, God and Satan, you know, Satan bargaining Job's life, basically, just for fun. And God, to some measure, allowing that to take place as a way to test Job as being proven through fire. Satan wants to destroy him with fire. God wants to prove him through fire. We'll look at that later on. Don't get too concerned about that right now, okay? But Job has no idea this has happened. We, the reader, know about this. Job, again, just woke up one morning, and then by the end of that day, his whole life is wrecked. And that's all he sees. So notice, he doesn't say, "Oh, Satan, you did it again. I hate you." He has no knowledge that Satan's involved in this at all. And he, even though he credits God to this, he's not blaming God either. Again, what does he say? The Lord gave and the Lord's taken away. It's just a matter of fact for Job. The sovereignty of God, we won't look at it today, but I'll just plant that in your brain. Just keep it there. We will come back to that theme over and over again in this series. Job had this deep belief God is completely sovereign. The Lord gave, the Lord took away. I'll mention just a few quotes here, then we'll get on to the next point here quickly. In his book, Exalting Jesus in Job, David Allen says this: "Satan may have received God's permission to afflict Job, but Job never gave his permission for God, Satan, or anyone else to turn his life into total havoc by this onslaught of tragedy and suffering." See, again, Job has no knowledge of this cosmic courtroom scene. He has no idea of why anything that's happened to him has happened to him. He just knows the Lord gave everything I have, and I'm guessing he's the only one who's able to take it away, and we'll look at the rest of that statement here in just a minute. But then another quote from the book, it's called The Book of Job. Wow, what a great title. John E. Hartley, he writes this: "It is difficult enough," catch this, "it's difficult enough to endure a hardship to achieve a specific goal. But to suffer misfortune for no apparent reason plunges a person into agonizing self-doubt. Coping with the sense of meaninglessness is more difficult than coping with the material losses." So it's easy for, I think we'll get a better view of Job's psyche even next week on a more negative space, because he's a normal person. So when he faces this kind of tragedy, he's not just saying, "Oh, I guess God just had a plan." That's not, it seems like his initial response. I think after next week we put these two together, we'll get a better view that he's struggling. He's got some deep questions. That's why we still have, 40 more chapters in Job to go. There's a lot of questions we got to work through. There's a lot of things we got to think about, a lot of things to consider here. And so Job's just getting started on that journey. So there are aspects of this that Job is going to find difficult to handle. But it never becomes problematic for him to the point of disbelief. Even now, in the immediacy of this moment, he shows honesty here. He shows fortitude here, and I think that's pretty commendable and something that maybe God can challenge us to do in our tragedy and loss as well. And then what's even more commendable is what he does next. So he acknowledges his loss, yes, but then the second thing he does is he worships his God. He acknowledges his loss, and then he worships his God. Go back to Job 1, 20 and 21. Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground, and worshiped. And what did he say? He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away." The rest of that line is, "Blessed be the name of the Lord." So these two verses are very much a worship song. I'm grieving, I'm acknowledging my loss, but I'm going to worship in spite of that, or as a response to that. So Job is a wisdom literature. We looked at that in the first week. And these verses, I think, show great wisdom in what worship actually is. It's not singing three or four songs on a Sunday morning once a week. Worship is a lifestyle. Worship is an attitude. Worship is a thing that we do on a regular basis. It's how we live our lives. And so Job is showing us the wisdom of worship. I think one thing that he points out, I'm going to quote C.S. Lewis a couple times here for a minute, because he points out two of these things. So there's two works I'm going to quote here quickly. The first one's called A Grief Observed. This is a work he wrote about 1960 after watching his wife die of cancer. There's the work that was compiled about that. And the other one that we'll quote in a minute is called The Problem of Pain. He wrote that one about 20 years earlier. So what's funny is he wrote sort of the theoretical response to how you might respond to pain theologically. But then he wrote sort of a different view of that when he's actually going through it. But both these together are very powerful. I'd recommend them to you if you want to get into C.S. Lewis. Really short, pretty dense, but really good way to introduce you to this awesome thinker from the 20th century. So he brings us out this idea in his book, A Grief Observed. Here's what he writes. He says, "One never meets just cancer or war or unhappiness or happiness. One only meets each hour or moment that comes. All manner of ups and downs, many bad spots in our best times, many good ones in our worst." This is what Job is describing here, I think, in Job 1 and 2. He's showing us the wisdom of worship, how worship helps us to see things in a very helpful, specific way. What Job is showing us, as we'll see throughout our study in the coming weeks and months, is that no one is completely immune from suffering. No one. No amount of money, status, or power can prevent some type of suffering from coming at you. You just can't escape it. In a similar way, however, though, is everyone's suffering is unique, but still everyone suffers. Sometimes we like to compare who's suffering more or who's suffering less. You know, we make a chart, we make this, you know, S tier, A tier, B tier of suffering. And it's like, okay, it's not a comparison game. Everyone's suffering is different. It might look comparatively more or less or better or worse, but the fact is everyone suffers in some way, in a unique way, just for them. And as both Job, I think, and as C.S. Lewis here says clearly, life, the wisdom of worship shows us that life is never all good or all bad. It's just a jumbled mess of both all the time. Sometimes there's more good than bad. Sometimes there's more bad than good, but it's never just one or the other. Worship helps us to see that, helps us to see clearly what's actually going on. What wisdom does, or worship does, is it alters our focus. So another C.S. Lewis quote from The Problem of Pain that he wrote in the early 1940s, he writes this. At first, I'm talking about human suffering. He says, "At first, I'm overwhelmed, and all my little happinesses look like broken toys. Then slowly and reluctantly, bit by bit, I try to bring myself into the frame of mind that I should be in at all times. I remind myself that all these toys were never intended to possess my heart, that my true good is in another world, and my only real treasure is Christ." So the wisdom of worship alters our focus because it takes the focus off of me. Worship is not about me in any way. If it's about me, it's about me being a vessel of worship to one who is greater than I am. And so then when pain, suffering, tragedy, loss comes, I'm already focused in the right direction. If I have this worship attitude, this worship lifestyle, a life of worship reminds me the things that I have are only good gifts because they came from a good God. The Lord gave, the Lord can take away. And so then the inverse is also true. The losses that I experience are only really deeply seen or felt as a loss because they were gifts from a good God. So I'll let that maybe sink in for a second. I'm saying that again out loud, and I'm like, I think I agree with myself, but I don't know. Anyway, you know, that happens once in a while. But a life of worship helps us to see the gift giver as also the true gift, and not focus on the things, the stuff, the material things, even my health and wellness, as the gift itself. Because that becomes a me-centered way of life. And so when those things are taken, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to react. I can't cope. But if I'm living an outward lifestyle of worship toward God, He's the gift giver and the gift, then when those other secondary gifts come and go, they're maybe easier to manage, if you will. Not easy, but easier. But this leads, as I mentioned, this leads to what I would call not just the wisdom of worship, but then there's a challenge that comes along with that. There's a challenge of worship. The challenge is, will I really worship with my life? The challenge is, will I worship in that way that will help me when those moments of loss come? One more quote from another work. This is called Piercing Leviathan. We'll talk about Leviathan in this series. So if you don't know what that is, Google it. It'll be a lot of fun until we get there. So just blow your mind, all right? So Eric Ortlund writes this in this work. Here's the challenge of worship. He says, do God's people love and fear God for His sake as an end in Himself? Or is God used as a means to some other earthly end, such as having enjoyable lives? Will we enter into a relationship with God in which all we ultimately gain is God? Can we keep the secondary blessings we accrue in that relationship truly secondary and dispensable? That's the challenge of worship, and that's the challenge of the book of Job. But remember Satan's challenge to God about Job? If you touch him, he'll curse you. If you take stuff from him, he'll curse you. And in fact, Job's response is the exact opposite, isn't it? He doesn't say, curse be the name of the Lord. What does he say? Blessed be the name of the Lord. He's doing the exact opposite that Satan guaranteed God he would give. So he's living this life. He's checking the box. He's meeting the challenge of a life of worship. Blessed be the name of the Lord. One modern example of Job is a man you may or may not have heard of. His name is Horatio Spafford. So he's a Christian businessman who lived in Chicago in the mid-1800s. And he went through a period of a Job-like season in his life. So in 1870, his four-year-old son dies of scarlet fever. And the next year, in 1871, they lived through the Great Chicago Fire, where he has great personal loss in his life. Then 2 years later, in 1873, he decided he was going to take his wife and their four young daughters between the ages of 2 and 11 on a trip over to Europe on a steamship. And so they go by. He's being delayed by business for a few weeks, and so he sends his wife and four daughters on ahead on the ship, and he'll meet up with them in a few weeks. Less than 2 weeks later, he receives a very short telegram from his wife. It simply says these two words, survived alone. So what had happened is midway through his wife and four daughters, their voyage across the Atlantic Ocean, they were struck by an iron sailing ship. And in that accident, 226 people died, including all four of the Spafford's young daughters. So Spafford gets this telegram, immediately makes his way to the port, gets on the next ship out to Europe to meet his wife. And as they're passing across the middle of the Atlantic Ocean over the spot where his four daughters perished at sea, he takes out a pen and a piece of paper and he writes these words. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, Thou hast taught me to say, it is well, it is well with my soul. Worship wisely challenges us to alter our focus. How can someone experience loss like Job or like Horatio Spafford? How can someone do that? It's this meeting the challenge of worship. Seeing the wisdom of worship, seeing God as not just the gift giver, but the gift. And if we do that, it's not easy or simple, but we can. It's possible we can say, it is well with my soul. And we can say like Job, blessed be the name of the Lord. The last thing Job does here in the opening two chapters of this book is he defends his position. So Job acknowledges his loss. He worships his God, and then he defends his position. So again, so far, despite the extreme tragedy in Job's life, he's had an incredibly healthy, positive, faith-filled response. But not everyone in his life shares his outlook, do they? Look at with me at these two verses, Job chapter 2. So he's out there scratching, scraping himself. Job 2, verse 9 and 10. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So now we get to Job's lovely wife, and this is the moment we've all been waiting for. The reaction of Job's wife is usually seen in one specific way, okay? So I'll share that with you, but I also want to propose a possible second way we can view her reaction here in Job chapter 2. So the first way, 99% of people would see it this way. Job's wife is bitter and angry. And honestly, if she is, you could understand why she would be, okay? These were her kids too. This was her fortune too. She feels violated too. She's affected by this too. And so she's not ready to worship God like Job is. She's not there yet. She's not going to look at the silver lining like Job is. She's not going to, you know, she's going to really get good and mad at God for a while. Shake his fist, you know, curse him. And she's kind of peeved with Job that he's not really mad enough. Like, you should be more mad. This is not right. That's sort of typically how we see her response. And that could be what she's thinking or feeling. Let me give you a second way that I think we can faithfully see the text in this way. There could be a second way that we view her response, not as being bitter and angry, but as being a scared and concerned wife. Totally different the way we read this. It's the same words, but a different psyche. So she, like Job, was just as surprised as anyone at the suffering. Life as she knows it is upended on this day, just like his. There's no rhyme or reason to this, and there's seemingly no hope for this. And so she's scared and concerned. How are we going to survive? All of our cattle gone, all of our oxen gone, our land is burned up, our kids can't provide for us now because they're all dead. Like, she's probably thinking, how are we going to make it? What are we going to do? And on top of that, now her poor husband is inflicted and infected with sores all over his body. So even if there's something they could do, he's in no physical condition to provide for them anymore. What are they going to do? So it's possible, it could be, that what she's trying to do in some weird way is give her husband a way out. She's not mad, she's scared, she's concerned. She's thinking of an escape hatch. How can I relieve my poor husband's suffering? How can I make all this stop for him? So it could be she's thinking, honey, I hate to see you like this. I don't want to see you suffer. If you curse God, maybe he'll put you out of your misery. Like, maybe that's your way out. Maybe if you do that, it's funny, that's what Satan said in Job 1, and that's what she's saying maybe in a different way. But she's saying, just let God end your suffering. Maybe if you curse him, he'll make you the suffering end. It could be either way. But either way you want to read that. And I love the sympathetic part. I've never thought of that before until studying for this, but it's interesting. Either way, no matter how you spin that, Job's response is, you're being foolish. We're not going to talk like that. That's not the way forward. We're not doing it. And so if you look at option one, she's angry and bitter. He's saying, don't be faithless. He's saying, anger is not going to help you. If it's option two, he's saying, I'm not going to give up. Don't give up. Stay with me. Stick with me. We're going to work through this together. We're going to find a way through this together. He defends his position. So there will be times in your life where the people in your life are not going to understand your faith. It's too much for them. Or it's too little for them. Like, how? Like, all the stuff that you've been through, and you still, like she says, you still hold fast to your integrity. God's been so bad to you, you're going to still be so good to him. It doesn't make any sense to them. And so you're going to sometimes have to defend your position with people. Maybe they're angry and bitter. Maybe they're being mad at God for you, you know. Maybe they're mad that you're not mad enough at God. Maybe that's what it is. Sometimes, maybe like Job's wife, they're scared and concerned. You're going to get really hurt. If you stick with God, and he doesn't really love you, can you see how your life's going? This doesn't make any sense. You're going to get killed. But again, Job's position is expressed, I think, again, look at one more quote from The Problem of Pain, and then we'll be done here in just a second, okay? C.S. Lewis writes this in The Problem of Pain. The real problem, okay, well, this is big, okay? The real problem is not why some humble, pious, believing people suffer, but why some do not. So Job's response here is this. he's not saying, why am I suffering? But his response is, what makes me think I shouldn't suffer like everyone else? It's a big thing to consider. He's thinking, what makes me deserve to avoid suffering? Why should I be immune from suffering? And really the question is, how else is our faith proven if not through suffering and loss and sadness and tragedy, disaster? What is faith good for if everything's always good? That's Job's perspective here. It's a crazy thing, but it's absolutely sound reasoning. He uses this sound reasoning to defend his position. One final quote, and then I'll let you out of here. We'll celebrate for just a few minutes together. Eric Ortlund, again, in Piercing Leviathan, let me just leave you with this idea, and then we'll close. He says this, "The costly affirmations made in terrible pain do more than show the quality of our love for God that exists hidden inside us. They seal and bind us in a relationship with God where God is proven as being of all-exclusive worth." As hard as it is to say, and as much as we don't want to say it, pain is the way to prove how good God is. Well, if you're not there yet, we got a few weeks left. We'll get there. But pain, suffering, tragedy, loss, that is the way that God ends up proving himself to us in our lives every day. And we have to defend that position with some people. Sometimes we have to defend that position against ourselves. I don't want to believe that. I don't like that. It doesn't sound good, but that's what we have to do. So may Job's response here be our response. When those things in life happen that you didn't see coming, that knock you for a loop, that threaten to tear the very fabric of your life apart as you know it, we can sit there and scrape for a while, but we can't stay there. We've got to worship God, trust God, use the faith God's given you to bless God as a proper response, even when all you have at the moment is a broken pottery shard and an ash heap. Let's pray. God, we've lived long enough to know that suffering happens, loss happens, tragedy happens, pain happens. We get that. And so may our response be like that of Job. We're not trying to follow a formula. We're just trying to walk this life of faith, this path of faith. And so help us as we deal with real problems and as we deal with real emotions and our feelings fluctuate. God, we can cast our cares upon you because you care for us. God, help us to maintain a posture of worship and a life of worship, our eyes fixed on you in the good and the bad. May we see the wisdom of this and meet the challenge of living this life of worship. And then even when others around us don't understand, help us to still put our faith into practice, to live it out, that it's proven over time. It's proven through the bad and the good. You do that. We place our faith firmly in you and walk firmly in faith, walk by faith. That's the only way. Thank you for the faith you've given us to do that, that you provide strength, clarity, wisdom to meet these challenges head on and say, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Thank you for that faith that we have even this week. We thank you for it in Jesus' name. Amen.